I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Chances are you have shopped online like millions of other Americans who enjoy the convenience, the selections, and the fact that you don't always have to pay a sales tax. Those days may be over as the U.S. Congress takes up the Marketplace Fairness Act. It would require online stores to collect state sales taxes if their annual sales were more than $1 million. The Senate approved the bill yesterday. It faces a tougher fight in the House. Supporters say that it would level the playing field for bricks and mortar retailers who have lost business to internet commerce. Critics say it would be too burdensome for businesses that would have to collect taxes for up to 50 states. Well, today on Radio Times, the pros and cons of the internet sales tax. We have two guests who have joined us. Megan McArdle is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, covering business, economics, and public policy. And Megan McArdle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Michael Mazaroff, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, joining us from their studios. Michael Mazaroff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, let me begin with you, and even going back to 1992 when the U.S. Supreme Court made its ruling, did it make sense back then, 20 years ago, to have a sales tax exemption for internet commerce that was really just in its infancy?
Well, of course, at that time, there really wasn't any internet commerce. There was a lot of online catalog shopping. There was TV, home shopping. But yes, I think it made sense at that time. I mean, even at that time, state and local governments were losing a significant amount of revenue from a tax that they were owed. It's very important for people to know that this tax is due whether or not the company you're buying from charges it to you. So if they don't charge it to you, you are legally obligated to pay the tax directly to your state tax department on anything that you buy online or from a catalog that would be taxable in a store.
And that's part of an honor system, and I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm predicting that probably most people have not paid that tax.
I'd say you're probably right, but if people look, they can look right on line 25 of the Pennsylvania personal income tax return, and the line is right there for you to pay that tax every year, and there are instructions in the book on how to do it, and they even allow you to do it, do a flat amount based on your income and not even have to keep your receipts.
And I do want to get to you, Megan, but going back to you, Michael, then why do you support the Marketplace Fairness Act?
Well, there are two reasons. State and local governments are losing somewhere between $10-20 billion of revenue annually that they, you know, desperately need in a time where their revenues have been depressed by the economic slowdown, and they've been forced to cut education and health care and child care, and this would obviously not solve their fiscal problems, but it would help them perhaps restore some of those cuts. And equally important, as you said in your setup, is that this has been terribly unfair to local merchants who have been put at a significant competitive disadvantage by companies like Amazon that are able to sell without collecting tax. And so they start out in the marketplace in Philadelphia with an 8% price disadvantage, and around the country it's even higher than that.
Well, let me go to you, Megan. What are some of the reasons for retaining this tax exemption?
Well, for one thing, if you look at, this is not really a problem for Amazon. I mean, the interesting thing is that from a lobbying perspective, this is a big battle between Amazon and Walmart, functionally. It's between the big retailer, the big retailers against basically eBay, who doesn't want their smaller sellers to have to pay the tax. So I think that, you know, you look at the reasons, why don't small sellers want to pay this tax? Well, for one thing, if anyone has ever filed tax returns in two states, you know what a big deal this is. Even if the tax return itself is easy to fill out, and you know these days TurboTax will fill it out for you, I've certainly had the situation when doing this where you then have to argue with two different states over what income was earned where. Someone comes back and says, no, I want this little piece of your income. That's a big managerial overhead. Again, not for Amazon and Walmart, who can hire a fleet of people to do nothing but argue with state sales tax authorities. But also, what a lot of people don't think about is that each sales tax regime is a little bit different. So things are taxed differently in each state, and if you have inventory, if you were an e-tailer, and you need to take a product and figure out, how it needs to be classified for each of 50 different states, that's a huge overhead. Mm-hmm. The issue is not, as with TurboTax really, right, the issue is not typing some numbers in. The issue is figuring out what your income was, what was taxable, and when you have to do that in multiple states, I mean, you think about, for example, in Wisconsin, ice cream cakes may or may not be a prepared food, which is taxable, or they may be a grocery, which is not taxable, depending on, for example, whether the grocery store decorates it. But ice cream bars are always a prepared food. Now, that is not the case in every state, so you have to figure out for each state, ice cream's not really an issue, but this goes across categories. And so you have to figure out, for each state, is this a taxable issue? Do I have to collect sales tax on that? And again, for Target, not a big deal. But for someone who's, say, employing 10 people, you know, how much time do you have to spend figuring out how your products get taxed in each jurisdiction?
And let me pick up on a couple of those things. I can't imagine a lot of ice cream cakes going through the mail.
No, right. This is what I say. Ice cream itself is not the specific problem, but it is an issue. There's a much broader issue with lots of grocery items and various other things. Do they count as prepared? A gift basket, for example, would be a good example of something that may be a prepared food and could be a grocery, depending on what state you're in.
Let me, though, part of this Marketplace Fairness Act, as it is called, says that states have to simplify their tax codes. Retailers would be given free software to help them deal with all these various taxes. Does that mollify you at all, Megan?
Well, so they do have to simplify a little bit in the sense that there's, in fact, about 9,000 tax jurisdictions in this country. And the good news about this is that you don't have to categorize everything for all 9,000 jurisdictions. And, you know, for a small retailer, again, it's kind of annoying, but you only do it once. If you have one store in New York City, you figure out what's taxable in New York City, and then you just run your business accordingly. This requires states to basically set one tax regime for all states. That still leaves 50 tax jurisdictions. And it also, remember, there's audit risk. And I've had conversations with people who say, well, you know, if they're really in good faith trying to comply, they won't get hit with big penalties. But, you know, the penalties are obviously something that e-tailers worry about, but they're hardly the only thing. Again, anyone who has ever been through a tax dispute that they have won, which I have, for example, when New York State decided that income I had paid tax on in Illinois should have belonged to New York State, I eventually won that dispute, and they said I was totally wrong. They sent me back a check.
Right.
But it took me 2 years, and it almost put a black mark on my credit. It was a lengthy process. Someone has to do that. And, again, doing that is time not spent running your business because for, you know, most small companies, the owner is really the person who's ultimately personally responsible.
Well, and let me pick up on that part of it and toss this back to you, Michael Mazaroff. The idea that for a small business, you've got not just one tax that you have to worry about, but multiple taxes to worry about. How does this act address that?
Well, it addresses it in two ways. It addresses in three ways, really. I mean, first, any business that has less than $1 million of interstate sales is exempt from having to collect tax except in states where they're located. So there's the small business exemption. Second, the act requires states to provide to all interstate sellers that don't have a physical presence where their customers are located software that facilitates the collection of this tax and the filing of tax returns and the remittance of the tax revenue. And third, there are some significant simplification requirements in the law that basically require the state to administer all the local taxes in the state as Pennsylvania does for Philadelphia and Allegheny County. So the problems that Megan has talked about, I think, are really being grossly exaggerated. I mean, the software is very capable of handling the identifying exactly the tax rate that applies where the product is delivered. Most merchants sell is going to be taxable in every state. Sales tax laws say that everything is taxable unless it's explicitly exempt, and the only things that are widely exempt that are sold by mail by small sellers are clothing and food. So unless you're selling those, virtually everything you're selling is going to be taxed in every state. And the software really is very robust. There are thousands of small merchants using it now. And as far as the audit issue that's being raised, I mean, states do not have, you know, hundreds of auditors to send across into other states to look at the books of small businesses. They barely have enough auditors to send out of state to do sales tax audits on Fortune 500 companies. So that's just a fear-mongering.
Well, Megan, let me go back to you ask you about the complaint from bricks and mortar stores, basically saying that e-retailers have an advantage over them. In Pennsylvania, 6% advantage over them because they don't necessarily have to charge sales tax. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first is that what the small bricks and mortar retailers are now asking for is to be given an advantage because they will now have to comply with one regulatory regime while their small e-tailing brethren are going to have to comply with 50. But beyond that, there's a couple things. First of all, this is not raising a lot of money. When people talk about how these cash-strapped states are going to get huge amounts of money from this, even with the most optimistic projections from the people who are supporting this bill, you're talking about 0.1, not even 0.1% of the total spending that is done by states and local governments in the United States. So we're not going to close any big budget gaps here. And similarly, when we look at the research on shopping, we don't actually see, it's really interesting, people don't factor in sales tax for most purchases. This is why, for example, shipping costs is another example of this, where you'll get an item that seems cheap and then a $15 shipping charge, even though they're just shipping it by the post office. And that's because we know that people actually don't consider those costs. They do for very large purchases, things like cars. But with cars, we actually tend to get the money back anyway because we require you to register it, and then we charge a hefty registration fee. And so I think that, a lot of retailers do, I think, genuinely feel that they are really losing a lot of sales to the Internet because of this. But, in fact, that's not what economic research shows. The other thing I would point out is that the reason Amazon is lobbying for this, and they have spent about $2.5 million at this point lobbying for this law, is that right now sales tax is governed by whether you have a physical location in the state. And so Amazon has been holding back on building warehouses in places in order to keep themselves out of states where they don't want to pay sales tax. That is changing for a number of reasons, but mostly because they want to be able to do next day and same day delivery to everyone. And so what I think is really interesting here is that Amazon is pushing this not because they want to be friends with small retailers. They're pushing this so they can put small retailers out of business. Mm. Once they get this rule passed, it will make it cheaper for them to open up businesses in all of these states, and that means warehouses, and that means that they're going to be doing same-day delivery to a lot of the customers that independent retailers, in my opinion, erroneously think they're going to win back by getting this law passed.
We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Megan McArdle and Michael Mazaroff, and we are talking about the Marketplace Fairness Act. It was passed yesterday in the Senate. It goes before the House and would force online retailers to collect state sales taxes on goods bought online. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents its annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend, May 11th and 12th. In celebration of Mother's Day, the trail features wine tastings and special treats for mom from noon to 5 p.m. at participating wineries. From the Skylands in northern Sussex County to the tip of Cape May, there are 6 different trails showcasing wines from more than 40 wineries throughout New Jersey. The annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend. Full details at NewJerseyWineTrails.com.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result? Well, it matters. Tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
Next time in Studio 360,
the short and talented Mel Brooks.
So you, I'm working for Mel Brooks.
What's funny, this is human behavior. Now, if we just exaggerate a little bit, these are what fools we are.
Mel Brooks is my guest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You can't beat that!
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So where do you stand on state sales taxes on online sales? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It's an issue before the U.S. Congress, the Marketplace Fairness Act. Talking with Megan McArdle, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, covering business, economics, and public policy, and Michael Mazaroff, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Michael, let me go back to you and pick up a couple of things that Megan was saying right before the break. One is her contention that this doesn't mean billions of dollars for states, that actually it's a lot less money than that if this sales tax were approved.
Well, it's difficult to estimate what you're not collecting, but the estimates that have been done by very reputable economists at the University of Tennessee. They've done a careful study, and their best estimate is that internet sales, the tax that's not being collected on internet sales is about $10 billion a year, and then others have done estimates that the tax not collected on catalog and home shopping and infomercial sales is about an equal amount. So somewhere between 10 and the top estimate I've seen is $23 billion. So no, it's not going to solve budget problems, but in this day and age, states really need every bit of revenue they can get to close their budget gaps and to restore some of the huge cuts in services they've been forced to make in programs. In Pennsylvania, for example, cuts in aid to higher education have exceeded 30% over the last 5 years, so this would help. So it's real revenue, and again, there are definitely people who shop online to avoid sales taxes. It's not the majority of people, and those people are really treating their local merchants unfairly when they go into those stores and they take the time as salespeople and then they write down the model number and go home and order it on the internet to avoid tax.
Showrooming, that's called, as I understand it.
That's the term.
Well, Michael, let me also ask you about something that Megan said about Amazon. And Amazon is interesting in that it had opposed this sales tax, and now it supports it. And from her perspective, it supports it because it sees that it can basically knock out some of these other retailers.
No, I don't think that's why it's supporting it. I think it's supporting it because the states have put a lot of pressure on the company, and they forced it to start collecting in a lot of states, and Pennsylvania being one of those states. Amazon had warehouses in Allentown for years and didn't collect tax because it took this dubious legal position that it didn't have to collect because the warehouse was nominally owned by a different part of Amazon. And so Pennsylvania cracked down on them, and Texas did, and Arizona did, an increasing number of states did. And so now that Amazon's being forced to collect in a lot of states, it doesn't want other of its competitors to have the same competitive advantage over it that it had over all those local bookstores for so many years. So it's understandable that it wants a level playing field too. But I don't think it's necessarily because it thinks it can put small competitors out of business. It's substantially done that already.
Well, and that's a topic for a whole other hour. But going back to you, Megan, I wonder, though, from the consumer perspective, if you don't have a computer, if you don't have a credit card, then you are, in a sense, forced to go to your local retailer if you're going to buy things, and you are going to pay whatever that sales tax is. People that are online have been able to avoid paying a lot of that sales tax because of this exemption.
Well, I think in this day and age, the good news is that no one has to be shut out of online purchases anymore. Local libraries have computer access for everyone where you can freely go in and use it for just the time cost of getting a library card. And now with prepaid credit cards, more and more people are able to access the ease and convenience of shopping online, which I think is great. And more broadly, there are risks to carrying around cash, and it's good that we have fewer people who are what economists call the unbanked. So I don't think that that's the issue. I do think there's a real issue with showrooming, which Michael brings up, but I don't think that this is really going to stop it. I think it is really actually sort of terrible to go in and use someone's facilities to preview a product and then go buy it elsewhere. But the people who are facing that problem are largely folks – like Best Buy. You know, I wrote an article back in December saying that I do think that Best Buy faces tremendous problems with this, Target as well, Walmart to a lesser extent, because they tend to have competitive prices. But usually for most of these things, with the exception of really big ticket computer electronics, people aren't looking at the sales tax. The other thing you can point out is that the stores in these jurisdictions are using facilities that are paid for by the sales tax. So if I go to my local Walmart and I go and shop there, well, they're hooked up to public water, and I may go use the bathroom there, or, you know, I like the products to be clean and so forth. They're hooked up to local electricity. They're using the local roads in a way that e-tailers are not. I mean, it is true, obviously, that UPS trucks go drive on local roads, but those taxes are mostly paid for by federal income taxes and by gasoline taxes and other use taxes that actually pay for the specific asphalt. So, while it is true that if you aren't shopping online, you are paying more sales tax than someone who isn't, it's also true that you're using services for that local shopping. The other thing I would point out is that...
Well, you know what? Hold on to that point, because I want to see what Michael Mazaroff has to say in response to that. The idea is when you kind of add it all up, it actually is a level playing field. Do you agree with that, Michael?
No, I don't agree with it at all. Number one, I want to go back to the first point about sort of the distributional aspects of this. And it's just, you know, low-income people can't afford to take a bus to the library and wait around in the library for an hour to get on a computer to save $5 in sales tax. And, you know, lots of them face barriers to shopping online beyond just not having a credit card. I mean, they may not live in a neighborhood where they can, you know, be confident that they can have a package left for them. So the fact of the matter is that this exemption really is really unfair to low-income people. They do not have the opportunities to shop online to avoid sales taxes that upper-income people do. And so that is a very important reason for supporting changing the law so that everybody has to pay a share of this tax. As far as the second argument, again, you have to remember this is not a tax on the out-of-state business. So the services the business is getting from the local government are kind of irrelevant here. This is a tax on the local consumer that the out-of-state business is collecting, and I would say that out-of-state business is benefiting sufficiently from the services that are being provided in the state where its customers are located to be required to incur, you know, the minimal task and effort in complying with this tax. It's the local buyer who is benefiting from those services, and that's what the tax is paying for.
Megan, let me go back to you, and then I do want to get some callers, and we have a lot of people that want to join our conversation. And I've noticed that those people who are supporting this Marketplace Fairness Act, they're not talking about it as a new tax. They're talking at using the language of closing a loophole. I think they were worried about Grover Norquist and company that might accuse them of raising taxes. Do you think that's significant?
I think it's silly to call this a loophole. The Supreme Court decision was made in 1992, was made for a very good reason, and it goes back to a lot of the things that we've been discussing, which is that the consumer is using services locally, and that requiring a business to collect a tax is a burden, and that state governments are not allowed to impose burdens on businesses who are distant from them, who are outside of their state borders. This is not some sort of little provision that was slipped in at the last moment. This is 200 years of constitutional law being applied pretty consistently. And the fact is most people do most of their shopping online, and this is why, while it is collecting billions of dollars, state governments spend about $3 trillion, state and local governments spend about $3 trillion a year. And so we're talking about a tiny fraction because the fact is, you know what, most of the stuff that you buy is going to restaurants and going to movies and getting stuff at Home Depot and going to the grocery store, and that's just not stuff that it is feasible to ship. And so in the overall scope of both revenue and distribution between poor people and rich people and all of those other things, these are really, really small differences that we are talking about here. It is big to some of these retailers who we are going to put a big compliance burden on, but it is not big to most consumers, and it is not big to most governments.
And that's Megan McArdle, again, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Also with us, Michael Mazaroff, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Let me get Craig from Collegeville to join us. And Craig, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm a small retailer on the internet. I sell both on eBay, Amazon, and my own dedicated website. And the biggest thing that I think isn't really mentioned here is the enormous cost for me to implement this. The first thing is that most states have a fee that you have to pay to get a sales tax number. In some states, it's as little as $10. In some states, it's as much as $100. As an example, in Montana, I sold one thing to Montana last year. I think I would have collected 87 cents sales tax, and I would have had to pay a $25 fee to register to collect that sales tax. So the cost for me, I estimate the first year, if I had to collect it, would be between $20,000 and $30,000 just to get it set up. And once that's done, it would probably be somewhere between $6,000 and $10,000 a year. Excuse me.
And Craig, I'm going to toss your question to Michael, but I have a personal question for you. Do you make more than $1 million in sales?
No, I don't, but I think it's really the million in sales is a low bar. I know some internet retailers who sell electronics and computers online, and they sell more than $1 million, but their margins are maybe 5 or 10%. So that's not a lot of money for profit. So they would be subject to this, and they could eat up maybe half of their income on preparing to do the sales tax.
Let me see what Craig Mazaroff has to say. Michael, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little puzzled by his example because Montana doesn't have a sales tax. But I agree that to the extent there are fees like that, that's a problem. And I would certainly support reducing them. But in terms of the larger compliance issue, it's really important to remember that the states have to provide software to the companies to allow them to collect the tax, and the tax can be very the software really automates the process. It ties into the shopping cart software of the company. It identifies the tax rates. It allows very simply for characterization of the inventory as to whether it's taxable or tax exempt. So that really will, and there are lots of small merchants using it now, and that will really mitigate substantially the efforts and the costs involved in complying with the tax.
Megan, let me go back to you. And Craig talked about paying a tax in Montana. Montana doesn't have a state sales tax, nor does Delaware, New Hampshire, Oregon. And I wonder whether, if this is passed, how those states without sales tax, how they're going to make out. Have you thought about that?
Well, I don't think it really changes anything for them. They're against it in general because, of course, these guys, everyone likes tax competition when they are the beneficiaries of it. But they're not collecting sales tax now. They're not going to collect sales tax in the future. There is, I think, some legitimate concern among residents of these states that maybe once the internet sales tax is passed, Oregon will look around and say, hey, maybe I should think about getting on this bandwagon. But I think the issue is less for them than for businesses that make more than $1 million in sales in their states. And, it doesn't actually sound like a huge amount of money, right? I mean, or rather, it does sound like
a huge amount
of money.
I was going to say it does, yes.
Right? If I were making $1 million a year, I would be very happy.
Yes.
But, for a business, it really depends on what the profit margin is. My grandfather ran a gas station in a small town in western New York and grossed well over $1 million in revenue every year, and it was not, I'm afraid to say, because my family were big fat millionaires. The profit margin on that was way less. On these stations is 1-2%, and so it's actually what really matters. The problem is you're going to have people who have high volume, like cable retailers and those sorts of things, but who aren't in fact pulling a lot of profit off of that they can use to pay an accountant to straighten out any issues that they may be having with state tax authorities.
Craig, thanks for the call. Let's see what John from Phoenixville has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have you, John? No, do we have John? No, we'll try to get John up and running, and we'll also give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. We have John. Okay, people were pointing at me. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I used to do business in Philadelphia, and I was sued by the local tax authority for $5,000 for sales tax I supposedly did not pay. And this has been a common practice in the city, where they just send out a letter that demands you show up in court and demand you prove you haven't paid sales tax. And I did not owe any sales tax, but it cost me about $1,000 in lawyers and accountants' fees just to get it straightened out. So now if I'm going to have more than 50 different entities wanting to sue me for sales taxes, what's going to happen?
Well, and we touched on this.
Who can afford that?
Well, we touched on this earlier. And Megan, is that one of your concerns?
Well, you know, I think that Michael does sort of exaggerate the difficulty of states doing this. And in my experience, and in the experience of many small business owners that I've interviewed, they don't. The first step is not that they dispatch an auditor to your. The first step is that they just go through their records, decide that you haven't paid, and issue a demanding letter saying that you had better pay up by a certain date, or they're going to slap you with interest and penalties and send an auditor to audit your books. And unfortunately, for you to fight that involves, at the very minimum, consulting your accountant, spending time looking up the relevant records, getting on the phone, in my case, just figuring out why they had decided I owed them tax. It turned out that they had lost my tax return from the relevant year and had just decided that I owed them money, even though, in fact, they owed me a refund. All of that stuff is actually what happens. They don't just send a guy out to your business. Obviously, they're not putting people on planes to far places. But sending letters is cheap. And when you look at states who, first of all, are in a revenue crunch, we all agree about that. But second of all, states historically have always loved to get business, to get money from businesses who are not within their borders. This is a sort of truism of tax law and also of court law, right? As you get lots of places where out-of-state defendants sort of tremble in fear if they get sued in those courts. And so the issue is, and something that the Supreme Court has been trying to step hard on, is the temptation to sort of disproportionately raise revenue by sending threatening letters to businesses in other places who don't have a legislator in your legislature that they can complain to when you start leaning on them. And I think that's, you know, one of the concerns that I'm definitely hearing about from some people.
And Michael, about 45 seconds before our second break, I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, my response is it's really not true. I mean, states don't want to try to collect tax from out-of-state businesses because it's very difficult for them to do it.
Because what? They don't have the personnel? They don't have the time?
They don't have the personnel. I mean, it's difficult for them to even discover if out-of-state businesses are doing business in their jurisdiction. So, I think it's probably more typical of the caller's experience that they focus on the businesses that are local and making sure they're collecting the tax. And sometimes they make mistakes.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Michael Mazaroff, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Megan McArdle, a special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, covering business economics and public policy. And we are talking about the Marketplace Fairness Act. It was passed by the Senate yesterday. It goes before the House, and if passed by Congress, would force online retailers to collect state sales tax on all the goods bought online. We want to know where you stand on this bill. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bryn Mawr Film Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY, presents Critically Acclaimed, an evening with your favorite film critics on Friday, May 10th at 6 p.m. A.O. Scott, Carrie Rickey, Stephen Ray, and Lisa Schwartzbaum will compare notes on beloved films, debate the future of film criticism, and answer questions. Dedicated to Roger Ebert, there will also be a private dinner with the critics where guests can challenge them one-on-one. For more information, BrynMawrFilm.org.
What do you do when you're little and you know you can't be like your mother? I adore and am proud of my mother, but what she wants from me is blind adherence to the mystifying virtue of seemly behavior.
On the next Fresh Air, Patricia Volk talks about her new memoir, Shocked, about her relationship with her mother. And we'll hear an excerpt of a recent lecture by Martin Scorsese about film history. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As the Boston bombing investigation continues, we'll speak with Muslims who want to tell us what they think their role is in monitoring members of their mosque. Also, niceness. Why do we applaud? Romans used to shake their togas. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain. Do you shop online? If so, your purchases could get a little more expensive as the days of tax-free internet shopping may soon be over. The Senate just passed the Marketplace Fairness Act, goes before the House, where it could have a tougher time. It would force online retailers to collect sales taxes on all goods bought online. I should say state sales taxes. Proponents say it's about time that online stores have to compete fairly with brick-and-mortar shops. And the sales tax could also be a welcome revenue source for state coffers. Opponents are arguing that imposing the tax is too onerous for small web retailers and could drive many out of business at a time when economic growth is so crucial. Talking about all of this with Megan McArdle and Michael Mazaroff, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, let me go back to you and something that was on Morning Edition this morning. Someone from the Tax Foundation quoted as saying that this is an entirely new frontier for taxes. Historically, taxes have always been tied to physical location. People pay income tax where they live because that's where they use their social services. Stores have paid taxes where they operate because they use local roads and so forth. But this bill is a proposal to collect taxes beyond geographical location. And he was saying this really forges new territory. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, as I said earlier, this isn't a tax on the out-of-state business. This is a tax on the local consumer for the services that they consume locally, and all we're doing is asking the out-of-state business to collect that tax, as many of them have to do already.
I mean, that sounds sensible, Megan McArdle.
Well, it actually sounds kind of weird to me. You say, imagine if I said, well, you know, we're just taxing Megan McArdle, and all we've done is asked a Walmart in Arkansas to collect the tax for us. I think the fact is that sales taxes aren't a very efficient way in the new economy to collect revenue. If you're really determined to tax these transactions, my thought would be, why don't we go to things like a progressive income tax? I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact that things like the fact that the sales tax is regressive, that it is paid more by people at the bottom of the distribution, not because they can't get on the internet, but because they consume more of their income. Well, it doesn't sound that sensible to me to say that we now have an out-of-state corporation that has no physical presence in the state, but is nonetheless required by the state to collect a tax that we're still saying is actually really a tax on the person and the services that they're consuming, not a tax on that business.
Well, that's a whole other issue, Michael, about whether a sales tax, or I guess a consumption tax, is really fair. I don't want to get too deep in that, but since McArdle offered, Megan offered that, does that sit with you?
Well, it does, to the extent that, you know, we're not at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We're not huge fans of sales taxes, and they are regressive taxes, but as I said earlier, changing the law in the way we've been discussing this morning actually makes them somewhat less regressive, because most of the people who are going to be paying tax that they owe now but aren't paying are relatively upper middle and upper income people. But I'd be perfectly content if states reduced their reliance on sales taxes and increased their reliance on progressive personal income taxes, as Megan said. But the reality is state and local sales taxes are a major revenue source. They're about 25% of all state and local taxes that these governments collect. And they're just essential to paying for schools and paying for health care and child care and all the things we want. And so as long as we're going to have them, I think we need to make them fair, and this is an aspect of making them fairer.
Let me see what Marilyn from Upper Black Eddy has to say. Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I was saying that, number one, Amazon has changed the game for everybody. I mean, if you want to buy a TV, you can go to a store, find out how much it is, then order it on Amazon and skip the sales tax. So it's not very fair. But for the person who said it's hard to collect sales tax, my understanding is that they're going to give you a program. The states are going to provide a program for your computer, and you'll get the program, and it'll figure out how to collect the sales tax. I mean, somebody with an online business understands computers. They'll understand the program. It's done. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. It's not fair for some people to pay sales tax and others not.
Marilyn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Megan, your response.
Well, I guess I would ask any of the people in the audience if they have used TurboTax to fill out their taxes, and if they think that having TurboTax made it not a difficult and time-consuming process. Because I certainly know that when I use TurboTax, I had better clear an entire Saturday, because I'm not getting out of there much before then. I have to assemble all of my receipts. I have to look up all my data. And in the cases where it has happened that the government has disagreed with the numbers that I got, I then had to get on the phone with the government and say, I don't understand, let's go through this. And that also has taken quite a bit of time.
Well, Michael, is it a technological problem then?
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that there are certain things that you can't automate. You can't automate, getting on the phone or writing a letter to the tax department. But, as I've said, the software is pretty robust. There are thousands of companies using it. It has to be provided for free. It's been designed to tie into most of the, major shopping cart packages that are in use. I'm sure if this law passes, eBay will turn around immediately and they'll, start providing this service to help their small merchants comply. They bought PayPal in order to have a payment system to help their small merchants get paid. They may very well turn around and buy one of these software companies to provide that service. So, I understand that, that businesses not having to do something that they've not had to do before are sort of concerned about the prospect and they'd rather not do it. But I think the fairness issue and to both consumers and local businesses is compelling.
Let me see what Joan from Newtown Square has to say. Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm for this tax because I believe in a consumption tax, which I think is much more fair than taxing people's savings or investments or inheritance. However, I think if it would be a flat tax across all the states, it would be more fair of a tax. And I also thought that I thought people were taxed on where it was shipped to, not where it was shipped from. If you could clarify that.
Sure. Megan, I'm going to toss that to you.
It is taxed on where it is shipped to, not where it is shipped from. That is one way that you could do it, by the way, is you could say that whoever is, you just tax it, the business where the business is physically located. The problem, of course, is that people are worried that, Oregon will then just have all these businesses and no one will open up an internet business in Pennsylvania. I think that there are arguments for a consumption tax. I think because we do want people to save, we regard this as a good activity. It's good for the economy. There are issues, though. I mean, someone who's living real close to the poverty line doesn't have a lot of room to save, and it seems unfair to pile a tax disadvantage on top of everything else. But if you're going to do a consumption tax, then the way to do it is that you do an income tax, and then you ask people to document their savings, which is usually a much smaller group of things to document, right? Some bank accounts, a couple of 401ks or whatever. And then you subtract that, you tax whatever is left over after you've subtracted the savings. You wouldn't do it this way. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that we're all saying this isn't a very good tax, but somehow we want to make it more efficient anyway to collect it. There are just better ways to do this if you do want to tax consumption.
Let me quote something else to you, Michael. This was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. Stacy Mitchell, senior researcher with the Institute for Local Reliance, quoted as saying, "The right time to fix this was a decade ago when it could have saved many more local businesses. It's beyond frustrating that Congress waited until Amazon became so dominant that having a massive tax advantage is no longer essential to its strategy." Is there some truth there, do you think?
Oh, there's a lot of truth there. I mean, this is way, way overdue. I started working on this issue back in 1989, and even at that point, the states had been agitating to get this problem solved for almost a decade at that point, when the problem was only sort of TV home shopping and catalog sales. So it's definitely long overdue, and it's Amazon has substantially built its business on this, and it's put local independent bookstores in particular all around the country out of business. But I'd still say better late than never. There's still lots and lots of businesses that are hanging on and are facing unfair competition because their competitors are not collecting tax, and they are. And the revenue loss, obviously, for state and local governments has grown enormously, and it still ought to be done.
Let me see what Walter from Elkins Park has to say. Walter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I built websites for a living, and I've built a number of e-commerce sites, both used in the U.S. and also internationally. And so I've dealt with integrating sales tax across Europe and the United States. And I just find it kind of a pat dismissal that there's going to be software provided by the states to handle their own unique vagaries of taxation when, if you've ever used the DMV site, for example, states are not exactly software developers. Mm. I've had a lot of difficulty integrating multiple tax rates for a single purchase. But, this is going to start to become an exponentially complex process for anyone who's trying to get online. And I'm afraid it's going to have a chilling effect on starting new businesses.
Well, let me see what Megan has to say and Michael has to say. Thanks for calling into Radio Times, Walter. Megan?
Well, I mean, I think that this is a real issue. That said, the states are using, I believe, there are some vendors who have some experience designing these softwares for big companies. So I think the issue is less that we're going to end up with the DMV website and more that we are going to end up with a bunch of small businesses who have a big new compliance burden. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that TurboTax just doesn't solve the problem of how do I know whether my new house addition should be added to the basis of my house to step it up for when I sell it in 20 years or not. Those are the real issues. Not the particular issue of software development.
Michael, we had someone write to Radio Times this morning who describes himself as a CEO of an approved vendor, basically saying that the free software that is required under the Act is actually a free service that provides fully automated solutions. And his analysis was that any kind of particular problems people might have could be solved within, as he says here, 15 seconds.
Well, I think that's right. There are two different kinds of ways of addressing the issue. Some of these software vendors have software that is loaded on your own computer, and then some of them are online sort of cloud-based services where your shopping cart system of the merchant sends the information to a server, and it kicks back to you the tax that's due, and you collect it, and it also will accumulate and file the return for you at the end of the period. So Megan's absolutely right that the way this is going to be addressed is not by states, 46 sales tax states developing their own program and expecting people to load 46 different programs on their computer. They're going to subcontract with the commercial vendors that are out there now and pay for those services so the tax can be collected.
Let me see what Bill from Westchester has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Yes, I have two comments. The first is that I have a lot of friends who are small merchants, and the ones that aren't brain dead anyway have established an internet presence via the marketplace in Amazon. The second thing is that the items that I buy them because they're not available locally, And also, sales tax is a very minor component of the purchase. Shipping costs are much greater. Mm. If I buy something, I bought items for $12, but the shipping cost is like $4.95 or something of that nature. So I don't see sales tax as being a real major driver of a person's desire not to buy or not to buy something local.
Well, let me see what Michael Mazaroff has to say. And we've heard this several times during this hour, Michael, which is that sales tax is not a big deal.
Well, I think for most people, that's right. It's not a big deal. Most increasing number of people are buying from Walmart, or they're buying from Best Buy, or they're like residents of Pennsylvania now who are having sales tax collected by Amazon. But there is clearly a segment of the market for whom this is a significant driver, and it's a significant amount of money. If you buy a $1,000 computer, it could easily be $100 savings in avoiding the sales tax. And as for the shipping cost issue, I mean, you hear that raised often as an objection to this legislation. They say, well, there's no competitive disadvantage because you have to pay shipping when you buy online. Well, you have to pay shipping when you buy something in a store. I mean, that merchandise didn't get on the shelves miraculously. It was shipped and there, and it was handled in the store and in the warehouse. So your local retailer hides that shipping cost in the price of what they charge you for the item, whereas the internet merchants have figured out that if they separately state it to you, you don't factor it in the same way that you do looking at the base price. But the point here is that we want to take the sales tax out of the equation as a factor in deciding whether somebody chooses to buy online or chooses to buy in a store. And if they prefer to buy online because it's more convenient, or they can get products that aren't available in a local store, that's fine. The whole point of this is to just level the playing field and take taxes out of the decision.
And Megan, we're almost out of time here. Do you think this Marketplace Fairness Act, do you think it will make it through Congress?
I think it is not clear what the fate is in the House. It has passed the Senate, but I really am not sure that the House Republicans are going to go for this. They would have to strip off some Republicans from a caucus that is just increasingly anti-tax and feels like it did its job by raising taxes on the rich when Obama asked them to last fall.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Megan McArdle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Michael Mazaroff, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Michael Mazaroff, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Megan McArdle, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, go to our Facebook page. We started a conversation on this very issue yesterday. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But stay with us. We'll be right back.